You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The earthquake that shook much of the East Coast a couple of weeks ago was followed only days later by what officials anticipated would be one of the worst hurricanes in history, and it forced many Americans to reassess what it means to be prepared in the event of a national or natural disaster. With the anniversary of 9/11 just 3 days away, the country is again reminded of perhaps the worst urban catastrophe of our time. And since the attacks, fighting terrorism has become a major focus of U.S. disaster mitigation and prevention efforts. In his new book, The Disaster Experts: Mastering Risk in Modern America, Professor Scott Gabriel Knowles examines the history of disasters in our country and the role of the experts tasked with making every effort to prevent them from happening again. It's published by the University of Pennsylvania Press, and I'm pleased to welcome Scott Gabriel Knowles to our show today. Hello.
Thank you, Leonard.
You define the word disaster in your book. Is yours different from the dictionary definition or the way that the general public tends to understand it?
I think the general public, often when they think about disasters, are focused on just the event itself. And it often seems like something that, you know, sort of drops out of the blue, or maybe a hurricane we're predicting a few days ahead of time. The definition that disaster experts are using when they think about disaster has much more to do with the vulnerabilities that are already out there in our society or in our infrastructure before the event actually occurs. And there's been 50 years of sociologists arguing about this definition, and to them it's important because they're really interested in the disaster's impacts on a community, on society. And so if you sort of understand a disaster as something that provokes stress in a community, then you prepare for it slightly differently, in some cases very differently than you would otherwise.
Well, who are these disaster experts you're referring to? Do they belong to a uniquely specialized discipline? Does it have a name?
I'm
disaster-esque expert?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose in a sense I've lumped them together because I'm interested in how they collaborate or sometimes how they don't collaborate. I mean, disaster experts are people out there in the United States who know the most about predicting and preparing for disaster, responding and recovery. But they can range in disciplines from epidemiology and emergency management to sociology. What unites them is that they, across the board, want to take a research-heavy look at disasters, and they want to use sort of expert practice and research to inform the risks that we take.
Well, you mentioned that they don't always collaborate. What's the problem?
Well, I think collaboration across disciplines is difficult, and this is definitely, you know, in the sciences. You know,
but they all have the same goal, don't they?
Well, they often do have the same goal, but they measure the success of, you know, in a different way. An earthquake engineer might measure success quite differently from the way a sociologist might measure it. And even within engineering, for example, if you're looking at, say, structural engineers, they might have sort of one standard of success for a building. This became relevant after September 11, whereas fire protection engineers might have a completely different standard.
We could say the same thing about people in China after the earthquake a couple of years ago destroyed schools and led to a lot of loss of life. There were a lot of different people being blamed, but in the end, it was because the buildings hadn't been built well enough.
I think that's right, and you know, I suppose all disaster experts are trying to reach some sort of consensus. What's interesting to me is what are the markers of those consensus? You know, is it a building code, a safety standard, a politician who successfully weathers a storm and comes out of it with a higher approval rating? And those measures are different. I think disaster experts at times are in pretty wild disagreement about how they should be evaluated. At other times, though, there is a pretty strong consensus.
Well, you write, a disaster mirrors the prevailing values of the society in which it occurs. Now, most of us think of disasters as being something that comes at random. So this hurricane moved inland instead of out to sea.
Right. Just take the last 10 years, for example. We've had some of the most expensive natural disasters in American history in the last 10 years. And there, people have asked that question. You know, why are disaster losses getting worse? And the answer to that, in part, is that there are more people in harm's way in coastal parts of the United States. So the disasters are mirroring risks that we're taking.
We build along the coastline, and we, to some degree, destroy the environment, actually leading to erosion and all sorts of other problems, putting those buildings in risk. And yet you can't tell people not to build along the coast.
this is one of the things that sets the United States apart from maybe other countries. You know, it's almost a sacred right in the United States, the prerogative of the property owner. It's an important, you know, and it cuts across party lines, right? And it's something that is not just a regional idea. And so our government has always, from the founding of this country, been reluctant to take land out of private development and to put restrictions on the way people use land. And I think that's, you know, whereas in Europe there's much more of a sort of a precautionary principle where engineers are tasked with actually showing all of the implications of their designs before they build something. We don't always operate that way.
Although we have had exceptions. I understand that Lake Tahoe has been saved because of an agreement between Nevada and California. You can't build a new hotel unless an old hotel comes down, and there always has to be an equal exchange because they don't want to see that kind of erosion.
It's true that you know, when we talk about sort of state and community level solutions to this, we're often seeing some very creative things. You know, I think in California, for example, there's some very interesting things happen right now around wildfire, where you actually have researchers, fire researchers, going to the state legislature and saying, can we just make maps available to people? And that's a relatively low-cost solution to a big, big problem.
Well, I'm assuming similar thing could have helped out in Texas, which is suffering from terrible fires now. Maybe Rick Perry doesn't believe that fires actually are caused by sparks.
Well, you know, wildfire has been, it's another thing. It's the losses from wildfires have been growing really dramatically in the last 20 years. But it's true that in states like Texas, that the idea of mitigation, you know, that you would take certain land out of development or that you would ask homeowners to bear certain costs up front, that's not politically saleable.
You start off your book with the destruction of the Twin Towers and the type of assessments that were done immediately after the attacks. What was the investigation protocol at the time, and who was in charge?
In the immediate aftermath, there was an organization that came into existence called the Building Performance Assessment Team. And this is in the aftermath of other major disasters like the Murrow Federal Building in 1995 and the first bombing of the World Trade Center. You had the Building Performance Assessment Team. It's engineers who come together from the American Society of Civil Engineers and FEMA. But they had some problems from the very beginning. I mean, even just getting access to the site. They weren't alone, obviously. They had trouble getting access to plans, to video and photos of the buildings in the period of time when they were on fire. So
why?
Well, part of it was that the city was entirely focused on, particularly in the first 30 days, recovering remains. And then for the next 9 months, they were really focused on removal of debris. And so those two things came first. The idea of an investigation, a sort of, you know, an autopsy of the building, was really not in front of people very much at that time.
Hadn't the towers been evaluated for airplane crash resiliency when they were constructed?
They were. It's one of the things that engineer Leslie Robertson still takes a lot of pride in. Those buildings were evaluated in a very innovative way for wind, the effect, and that's a very windy spot. And they did.
And people talk about feeling the building actually move on windy days.
They were engineered to withstand that and more because hurricanes do hit. You know, those were going to be the tallest buildings in the world at the time. To your question, they did evaluate also for impact of a Boeing 707, which was the largest plane that was existing at the time that it was on the drawing board. But the point to make there is that they were really, really taking into account whether or not the buildings would survive the impact. That is, would they stand if they took an impact of a plane? That's not a crazy idea. The Empire State Building was hit by a plane in 1945. So that was in the public memory, and at that point it was only 20 years previous to that. The thing that they did not spend as much time innovating on in the design of the Twin Towers was the life safety systems, the fire protection systems.
But the building didn't stand, and that's why there are all these conspiracy theories. But it was partly because of the way the building was constructed. Each floor just fell down on the floor below.
That's right. I mean, the progressive...
Couldn't anybody have predicted that?
Well, it depends on who you ask about this. You know, structural engineering community looks at this as a success in the sense that the buildings did stand in one case for almost an hour, in another case for almost 2 hours.
And they didn't topple over.
And they didn't topple over, right? And so if you're looking at it from that perspective, then that gave people people, particularly below the impact zones, the opportunity to get out. So you could call that a structural success, and I think many people in the structural community have pointed to that. Again, the fire protection community doesn't accept that. When they say, you know, the building stands is fine, but if everyone inside and above the impact zone didn't get out, then we got to be asking questions about stairwells, about fire suppression systems, and about fireproofing. And it's a debate that's still ongoing.
My guest is Scott Gabriel Knowles, who teaches history at Drexel University. His latest book, The Disaster Experts, Mastering Risk in Modern America, published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. Well, the rebuilding at the World Trade Center has taken nearly a decade, and Tower 1 is still only a little over halfway completed. Does this have anything to do with disaster experts taking their time in advising on how it could be constructed?
If you... In the 3 years after September 11, the largest federal study of fire protection and structural safety ever was conducted at the National Institute of Standards and Technology. It was a direct outgrowth of citizen action, actually. The Skyscraper Safety Campaign came together after 9/11, and they really pushed legislators to fund a full investigation. That took some time. Now,
but we had... some architects come on the show and predict that the era of the skyscraper was over.
That's true. But, you know, that prediction has a long history. You know, people have predicted in the late 19th century that the era of the tall building would be over, too, or that the era of the city would end because they couldn't control fires or earthquakes. I didn't really, you know, that conversation lasted a little while, maybe a year. But the fact is, the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation was already looking at plans, you know, in 2002. I mean, there was a conversation about reconstruction very, very early on. The question about what should be the right standard of safety for construction, though, that was not and still has not completely been solved. The developers, you know, Larry Silverstein developed World Trade 7, and that went up very quickly. And that thing is a model of it's a fortress, in a sense. I mean, it's in some ways the best example of the implementation of fire protection in buildings.
Well, all of the buildings are going to be fortresses, but is that what we want to start building from now on? There's a lot that's sacrificed when you build a fortress.
I think that's right, and I think architects have wrestled with that, and developers have certainly wrestled with that. I mean, you look at the kind of recommendations, for example, that fire protection experts have called for: additional stairwells, right? So a third stairwell is now suggested for any building above 420 feet. That's rentable space you're using. More elevators for evacuation. So from a development point of view, you're going to lose rentable space, which means dollars. And the other question of aesthetics is one that we see in the World Trade Center. The Freedom Tower has went through 4 years of design changes, and finally the New York Police Department said, you can't build it the way you want to. You have to build a bunker, basically, for the first 200 feet. And that's what the architect had ended up doing.
One of the things that nobody thought about, it seems, was elevator shafts. Yesterday, or I guess yesterday or the day before, we spoke to a woman who had just entered the lobby, and this fireball came down the elevator shaft almost immediately after the impact of the airplane.
Right. The elevator shafts, that question has been one where you've seen a great deal of innovation since September 11. And the whole question of whether or not you should evacuate a building using elevators, an expert in evacuation told me it's the only paradigm shift he's ever seen in his entire career. You know, forever we were told that you should under no circumstances get near an elevator in the case of a fire, use the stairs. September 11 caused people to rethink that, and now it's actually part of the code in New York that elevator shafts have to be made more resilient so we can actually use the elevators to get out.
My guest is Scott Gabriel Knowles, historian at Drexel University, author of Imagining Philadelphia, Edmund Bacon and the Future of the City, and now The Disaster Experts, Mastering Risk in Modern America, published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with Scott Gabriel Knowles. His latest book, The Disaster Experts, Mastering Risk in Modern America, published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. You have looked at three eras in the history of American disasters going back to the late 19th century. You call the first era the conflagration era. How widespread were fires during that time?
Well, whole cities were burning down. I mean, we know the most about Chicago in 1871. Boston burned down most of downtown in 1872. And then you had apocalyptic fires that would take out whole neighborhoods. Big fire in Brooklyn in 1876 took out a massive theater there, killed hundreds of people. It was a period of time when, the risk, the growth of the city, industrialization, the growth of the scale of the city, and the rapid population of cities. A city like Chicago, for example, was growing by 500,000 people per decade in the late 19th century, and so the risks were being created by the changes in the environment.
But isn't Chicago a great city because of the way it was rebuilt after the Great Fire of 1871?
Well, in fact, the fire occurred in the midst of an election season. And in the immediate aftermath of it, there was a party that emerged that called themselves the Fireproof Party. And what they argued was that you should rebuild every structure in the city should be built of brick. The immigrant German community, the working class of Chicago, disagreed with that because that was going to price them out. They weren't going to be able to afford to live. And so actually they came up with a compromise that said, over a period of time, we will transform the city into a city of brick. The downtown inside the loop was redesigned to have more masonry structures. But the fact is, by 1873, the city had been mostly rebuilt exactly the way as it was before, mostly out of wood.
And so it just lucked out that it didn't have another fire?
Well, they did have other fires, but they didn't have any that were quite that catastrophic. The point was that, growth was just too magnetic. I mean, there was no politician who was going to try to slow the growth of the fastest growing city in the world at that time.
What role did the insurance industry play in changing these things?
The insurance industry, the fire insurance industry, every fire insurance company doing business in Chicago in 1871 went out of business. The National Organization of Insurance Companies took a look at the rapid changes in cities. And you can kind of see the compromise they're trying to figure out here is they're going to write a lot of policies with the growth of cities. But if whole cities burn down, they're going to go out of business. So they have to figure out how to thread the needle. They have to be able to have cities where people are willing to live and people are willing to take risks, but those risks have to be managed and controlled to the extent in which they're not going to go out of business.
But they really didn't have the scientific or technical expertise to gather risk information. So how did they get around that?
They didn't at first. It took about 30 years, and it actually came from factory inspectors. It came from all sorts of different directions. It came from people in public health. It came from factory inspectors.
So we're talking about government having a role.
Government actually had a very, very small role. These factory inspectors were private. They were fire insurance inspectors who, a lot of them were in New England, who were out inspecting big factories, and they had written enormous policies, and there was a lot to lose. And they were able to convince their clients that if you would bring in certain kinds of technology, for example, a sprinkler system, we'll lower your policy. And so there was that sort of private sector push and pull going on.
One of the deadliest fires you write about occurred during this time, the Iroquois Theater fire.
Right.
What happened there? Wasn't it engineered as a fireproof structure?
Engineered and advertised as Chicago's preeminent fireproof building. It was very late in 1903. They had a big traveling show going on, and at that time, they were using arc lights, burned very hot, and all these oil-painted props, and the stage scenery caught on fire. Now, at that time, they had a couple of technologies they were very enthusiastic about. One was a curtain that was supposed to fall to shield the audience from flames, and that didn't fall. It fell sort of halfway and got stuck. The egress had these sort of signs and painted and doors, but the problem was the doors opened in, not outward. So people were trapped inside. The signs actually were obscured because the building had just been finished. So it was a whole package of failures sort of waiting to happen.
Were they officially violations at the time?
They were officially violations. The mayor, about everyone in Chicago investigated the disaster.
And then they
pointed the blame all at each other. The building inspector was blamed. The architect and the owner of the theater was blamed. The mayor was blamed. The mayor sent his team out with code books in hand. And they actually found that not a single theater in Chicago was up to code. The codes were great in the sense that they were very technically sound and sophisticated, but not a single building was living up to them.
So what did they do? Were they able to change things?
Well,
because then you wind up with people complaining, Well, you know, it's easy for you to say I have to be up to code, but right. this is going to cost a lot of money. You're going to put me out of business. We're still hearing that argument right. today.
All the theater owners actually went to the mayor's house as a sort of great story, and they showed up at his front door and said, you're going to put us out of business if you actually force us to follow these codes. That episode pretty much passed. There was a lot of conversation about better standards and better safety. They brought in an outside engineering expert to examine it. Nothing really changed. They changed the name of the theater. But if you look at the Iroquois as part of a larger era, so the Iroquois Theater happened just months before major fires in Baltimore, the General Slocum fire here in New York City, which killed almost 1,000 people on the East River, and then the San Francisco earthquake and fire in 1906. All those episodes closely grouped in time awakened public consciousness to start to connect the dots that these weren't just incidents in individual cities, but this was a national problem.
But you write about the political and financial level of risk tolerated in the country then, and can we say now as well? Anytime anybody says we need more regulation, others complain that you're going to put people out of work.
Well, I think that certainly that's the wire on which safety balances, right? This idea of protection and safety on the one side versus risk-taking and profit on the other. And you're never going to satisfy everyone. You know, politicians through time, though, have been much more enthusiastic about recovery and consoling victims than they have been about regulation on the front end, because there are no headlines in regulation.
But then after something terrible happens, then they say, we have to clean this whole matter up, and we need new regulations.
You show stability in the middle of a crisis. I mean, this is something that Rudy Giuliani did, right? And he rode that into a political career that went, he attempted
for a
to
moment.
Ride that. Yeah, right. But the idea was that if you showed sort of stability in the crisis and that you could console victims, that's politically viable.
Well, looking back at Rudy Giuliani's career, we might suggest that he check out your book, because it's called The Disaster Experts. He might try to figure out why his career turned out to be so disastrous. The Disaster Experts, Mastering Risk in Modern America. It's published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. My guest is Scott Gabriel Knowles, who teaches history at Drexel University. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. I want to quote a passage from your book that speaks to the message about our country's actions after tragedies. It is a standard lament heard after an American disaster. We have to learn from this tragedy so that it never happens again. The fact is that historical record is full and available. Disasters do not recur in the United States because of poverty of knowledge. Forgetfulness about risks and disasters is no accident. And it's hard to imagine that anyone has forgotten about 9/11 or Hurricane Katrina. But I have a feeling we're going to see something similar somewhere down the line. Maybe not the same, but something that people were predicting, the disasters that would occur as a result of Hurricane Katrina, and nobody listened. And some of the predictors have lost their jobs afterward.
This was really the question that inspired me to write the book, which is that if we have all these experts with all of this knowledge, if you look at Katrina, for example, we knew a lot about levees. We knew a lot about evacuation. They had done an exercise called Hurricane Pam, where they actually modeled what a hurricane hitting New Orleans was going to look like. But the disaster still occurs. So the question then comes, why are we not using the experts' knowledge? And I think that has reasons that we can chart historically. I mean, you mentioned Katrina. I mean, more recently, the War on Terror has had a big role to play here. The Department of Homeland Security, which is the third largest cabinet organization in the United States, after September 11, it completely changed the conversation about disasters away from natural disasters to terrorism. And when you make a shift that dramatic, and you completely take the eye off of these other kinds of disasters that we know are going to happen on a regular basis, that's getting at that point I'm trying to make, that we are sort of intentionally forgetting that hurricanes are going to happen.
Well, how different is the current situation from what happened after the bombing of Hiroshima, which you describe the civil defense era? There was a major shift to the threat of nuclear attacks, and there were experts at that time who suggested, I remember, that we climb under our desks and put our heads between our legs, and that was somehow going to protect us from the fireball from a nuclear attack and the radiation.
Right. I mean, they didn't call for plastic sheeting and duct tape, but they may as well have, right? I mean, it was eerie for me to watch, you know, basically on September 12th, it might as well have been 1950 all over again. The conversation, you know, was almost exactly the same. External enemy, we're all vulnerable, and we have to completely rethink the way that we look at our urban environment, and we have to be focused on one threat. In the Cold War, obviously, it was a nuclear attack. And the way that it played out bureaucratically was so similar. Civil defense became the central way of thinking about what the government should be doing in cities. We should be preparing for these nuclear attacks. The fact is that it never worked. The public never really believed that they would be made safe through civil defense measures. They would take surveys year in and year out, and they found the public believed a nuclear attack was going to happen and that there wasn't much that the government could do to protect them.
Well, you write about the unsuccessful atomic attack tests that were carried out in Philadelphia during the time. Why didn't they succeed?
Well, these were test exercises in some ways similar to the counterterrorism test exercises they do today. They would come up with a hypothetical narrative of the destruction of a city. I mean, these make very chilling, fascinating reading. They're easy to get. There was one done for Philadelphia, New York, Chicago, Seattle. And then the civil defense directors would call everyone together, all the experts, federal, state, and local, and they would get together and play this exercise. And the conclusion from the Philadelphia exercise, in this example, was hit by two atomic bombs, is that within 5 days the city would be up and running again and the factories would be humming along.
Nice.
Yeah, it would be wonderful. They were going to deliver, the water system was going to be destroyed, so they were going to deliver water in big tanker trucks. Well, were the roads going to be in shape? I mean, these are the kinds this is the kind of strange Lovian logic that you end up with in that kind of thinking.
You also write about sociological disaster research. One expert, the sociologist Lee Clark, went as far as to say that nuclear civil defense didn't make practical sense, that it wasn't rational. Was it that it was just too ambitious?
It was certainly ambitious. I mean, one has to give the civil defenders credit for what they were trying to do. I mean, to understand everything from continuity of government and our continuity of our economy to protecting every American from an apocalypse. But what Lee Clark points out, and what I think is important to compare to our current time as well, is that what it did was create this enormous bureaucracy, this huge federal top-heavy bureaucracy that was dictating to states and local government what they should be doing to prepare themselves. Instead of preparing for hurricanes, which happened in the 60s, or earthquakes, which happened in the 60s, they were preparing for the nuclear attack that never came. And even if the attack had come, there's very little evidence that the preparations would have worked.
Well, can you prepare for everything? Because we started preparing for earthquakes, and then we wound up with 9/11.
This, we don't know yet. I mean, up until September 11, the country was moving. Emergency management as a profession is developing. We're moving towards the idea of professionally looking at all these hazards in one skill set.
But, which you call the all-hazards era.
Right. And the focus there, and this was in the 1990s under James Lee Witt's directorship of FEMA, was on what they call mitigation, but it's basically just doing the things ahead of time that you need to do to understand what the risks are. Making a map, poverty reduction, communication, infrastructure, whatever it may be. But again, September 12th, mitigation went out the window in favor of terrorism.
Well, you write about the vulnerability paradigm. What's that? The
vulnerability paradigm is we're sort of imagining, again, this idea that there is no such thing as a natural disaster, that disasters aren't something that just happened to you, but that we live in a society that has vulnerabilities and exposures. And if you want to predict where the disasters are going to occur, for example, New Orleans, it wasn't very hard to predict that the communities that were going to be hardest hit by that were the most vulnerable communities by age, by race, by socioeconomic status.
But if we're in the all-hazards era, it's my sense that we are, to some degree, stressing something that harkens back to the civil defense era. There's a certain military mentality, and I'm assuming that other disasters or potential disasters are getting fewer resources. That's why we've seen the kind of flooding that we saw last year.
The Department of Homeland Security has spent upwards of $1 trillion for preparation for Homeland Security. But of that, every year, FEMA gets about less than 20% of the overall budget. So if you just look at the most recent budgets, the Transportation Security Administration gets 14% of the DH budget. FEMA, all of FEMA, gets 18%. So the fact is that we're doing a lot more to think about terrorism than we are to do with natural hazards.
What have been the toughest hurdles for disaster experts in carrying out reform? Are they getting in each other's way?
I think part of it is the nature of science. Scientists don't always agree, and their deliberations are productive. But from a policymaker's point of view, this is like the climate change debate, right? If there's one scientist who disagrees, then there's disagreement, and we can't make policy. I think that's a big hurdle. The other thing is that, you know, a lot of experts don't think about how to turn their knowledge into policy. And that's a process that I think we could spend a lot more time looking at as a society to help those experts actually get access to policymakers and to translate what are often very esoteric studies into actionable policy proposals.
Is this something that has to be done on a federal level, or are we going to be seeing it rather state by state?
Well, I think if we rely on that to happen at the federal level, we're going to be in trouble. I think we have to really think about local and state action. You know, the other thing I think it's important to stress, and this was true in New York, is that the public has a real role to play here. Again, Sally Regenhardt and others who took real action after 9/11 to call for this investigation, they're members of the public. They weren't really disaster experts. Now, she has become one. These skyscraper safety campaign folks have. They forced a congressional investigation, and I think that's something that the government was not going to do that study otherwise.
In your own estimation and talking to these disaster experts, is there a major disaster we should be preparing for that we're not?
I think that the trend is going to continue. Hurricanes, earthquakes, you know, major flooding, I mean, those are the things that we're looking at. They're costly, and they're happening more frequently, and they're going to, you know, I'm not going to make any predictions, but those are the things that we really need to be focusing on.
Scott Gabriel Knowles teaches history at Drexel University. His latest book, The Disaster Experts, Mastering Risk in Modern America, published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Leonard.